Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Law Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Loudon, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Law Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a great guest. I'm talking about Colonel Derrick Williams, whom I hold in high regard. I think we first met, Kiwi, whenever, when did we first meet? Maybe when we were working on the creation of SANS. I think that might have been the first time. It's about 10 years ago or so.
That's correct.
And then, Derrick and I have had lots of conversations over the years, and we have these long text messages back and forth from time to time over current events. And so there's been a lot of stuff that's happened lately, a lot of news that's come out, a lot of things that are impacting the stability of nuclear deterrence and sort of what we think about it. And for you as a planner, this is something that you think a lot about. And so I thought, let's have Kiwi on the show and let's talk about some of these events that could shape and impact, our thoughts and, the way we as the United States handle deterrence and the way we as the Department of Defense handle it. And so with that in mind, let me just sort of open up, there, Tom DiNonno, the Undersecretary of State, and Chris Yaw, the assistant secretary who works for Tom, they both came out here recently and said that they, they believe that China conducted a nuclear test a few years, it was a 2020, right? I think is whenever it was.
2020.
And it was,
June,
we haven't really,
2020.
And it's something we hadn't really heard much about. So back then it wasn't, it wasn't all over the news. So can you maybe tell us a little bit about this and why, this much later, why do we care about it?
So it's pretty interesting because normally we don't comment on things like this, mainly because we're concerned about adversaries having an idea on where our detection thresholds are or are not. So we kind of just leave it ambiguous of where those areas are and classify those so that people can't figure out where they can test and where the exact line is, and then they have more concern. Because now all of a sudden you're like, well, can I get away with hundreds of tons, or can I only get away with tens of tons? Can I get away with pounds? What can I actually get away with? So it makes your adversaries have to guess, more conservative, and then they have that fear that they're going to get caught and that then we're going to, tell the whole world of what happened. So back in June of 2020, as Tom DiNonno kind of spoke out, said there was a test, and then Chris kind of came out and clarified a little bit more and said that it was a decoupled test that they believe was in the hundreds of tons. So to put that in perspective, when you think about Little Boy on Hiroshima, it was 15 kilotons, or you think about Fat Man on Nagasaki, that was about 21 kilotons. So this is an order of magnitude reduced, two orders of magnitude reduced, down from, instead of just kilotons in the single digits, now you're talking into could be 100 tons or even lower. But with the decoupling, what it does is if you dig out a cavity, you can actually prevent the shockwave from coupling into the geology, and it muffles out the signature that goes into the rock. And then that will reduce the amount of seismic activity, the P waves that go through that Byron talked about a few episodes back, Byron Resfitt, who was a senior mentor of mine when I went through the Sandia Weapon Intern Program, national treasure. And I recommend everybody go back and listen to that episode because he goes in depth about a number of these topics. But when you go in there, you start realizing that, okay, so China conducted this test. What can they really get out of this? So one of the things that Byron discussed was the alpha curve and how many generations per unit time do you have, and as you go out, and that gives you a whole lot of information on the performance of not only a nuclear explosive, but especially in thermonuclear systems where you're trying to drive the primary and get the primary to then drive the secondary. So this gives you a lot of information along that. Now, what Byron talked about was something called hydronuclear testing. Now, the definitions are a little fuzzy on this, but normally it's considered whatever high explosive energy you put in or mechanical energy you put in, you'll get out in fission yield. So if you have, let's say, 50 pounds of high explosives, you'd get 50 pounds of fission yield out of your nuclear explosive. Now, this is much higher than that, because if you're thinking about even going back in time to something like Fat Man, which had roughly about 5,000 pounds of high explosives. So now you're thinking about 2.5 tons. Well, what we got out of Chris and Tom was that we're talking about hundreds of tons of yield. So much higher up. And now you're actually able to get a number of different pieces of information. Something that I've always found interesting is you'll hear from the arms control and disarmament community, especially when we were talking about the ratification of CTBT through the U.S. Senate in the late 90s, and then even going on in the 2000s, and then even going on to when President Obama was in office and was discussing during his NPR in 2010 about seeking ratification of the CTBT, about what is a militarily significant nuclear test. I think that this is quite silly of a term to use. If you think about our own science-based stockpile stewardship program that combines not just modeling and sim through advanced computing, but the key is experimental actions that happen that go to verify those codes and provide additional information so we can further refine them and get additional information out of them. So things like JASPER, which is the Joint Actinide Shock Physics Experiment Research Facility, long name, NNSA loves their acronyms just as much as the Department of War does. But this is just a gas gun that basically runs a shock wave into a piece of plutonium or uranium, and it helps gather equation of state. Well, this is all used to verify physics code. It's not in a weapon representative geometry. It doesn't look like a nuclear weapon or anything. This is like a science experiment that you would run, but in this case, it's on actinides, which normally, you know, uranium and plutonium don't really happen at most physics labs or universities. This is happening in, you know, in NNSA facilities, specifically down at the Nevada National Security Site. But those pieces of information are critical to our science-based stockpile stewardship program and our ability to verify that it's not just the codes that are running, and we're not just comparing them to our long test history. As we talked about before, 1,054 tests of about 1,149 different devices. Some of those were joint tests with the US and the UK, about 28 of them. The UK, strangely enough, only claims 24 because four of them were considered shipping and handling tests, which they didn't really consider tests, but we do as the US because they were involved in different things. But those things go into verifying all of these codes. So it's not just like we're out there just running these things and trying to make a match what we've done in the past, but we're trying to gather additional data. This is one of the reasons why you've seen during congressional testimony and such, a lot of different folks through NNSA and DOE talk about specifically that we know more now about how nuclear weapons work than we did in the era of full yield testing. And the reason for that is when you did full yield testing, it's kind of like a cheat code. You jump out and you find out, well, did I get the right answer? Did I shake the earth? Did it work or not? Well, when you take that component away, now you have to get down to the nitty-gritty details of exactly how everything functions. So other facilities like the National Ignition Facility out in Lawrence Livermore that a few years ago finally reached ignition. Well, ignition was never the point of NIF. NIF was there for an experiment to understand how the thermonuclear phase or fusion phase works in a nuclear weapon. So by those 192 lasers providing that unique high energy density physics, we were able to gather a lot of information that we're able to go back into those codes that run in advanced computing and verify information. But yet again, this is another configuration that's not the same as a weapon. So the fact that people look back up and they go, well, it's not a militarily significant yield. Well, what I do out in NIF isn't a militarily significant yield. It's not in violation of the CTBT. It doesn't do anything of the such. But it still gathers critical experimental data that goes back in and supports our science-based stockpile stewardship program. But the one thing that all these tests don't do is they don't go into actual supercritical yield, and they don't represent, in most cases, with the exception of one, a weapon representative geometry. I should say, with the exception of two. So there's actually the dual access radiographic hydrodynamic test, which is DART, that happens out at LANL, out Los Alamos. And then you also have PULSE, the principal underground laboratory for subcritical experiments. And there's actually an enhanced capability for subcritical experiments facility that's being modified there. Those are the two places where we can do weapons representative geometries for primaries specifically, but to look at what happens during those parts. At DART, they only use uranium or plutonium surrogates, and then they're always making sure that they're staying subcritical. In the case of DART, usually using uranium-238 to make sure that that happens. And then down at PULSE, in what used to be called U1A, that facility does handle plutonium, but they scale everything down to make sure that at no point do you reach criticality, so that we can stay aligned with not only the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which we did sign, but we never ratified and has not entered into force, but also with the presidential moratorium on nuclear testing. So those are a number of different things that I think are important to think about when we look at the Chinese experiment or test, depending on how high up they went and where we draw the line. Like Byron mentioned, there's not really a clean line. We talk about the zero yield test ban treaty and never going above criticality. But as Byron mentioned, you know, 5 tons for Russia was kind of where they believed that a nuclear explosion really started. So if you're in the hundreds of tons, now you're much further along than even Russia would consider as leaving that kind of hydronuclear environment and getting into a nuclear environment.
And so just for our audience, you want to, you know, for a conventional, our largest conventional explosives, what kind of yield do they offer?
Yeah, so 30,000 pounds, which is about 15 tons, happens in the MOAB. Which everybody calls the mother of all bombs. If you think about MOP, the massive ordnance penetrator, the GB-57, when that was released over in Iran, he has a 30,000 pound munition, but he has about 5,000 to 6,000 pounds of high explosives. So now you're talking about roughly 3 tons of high explosives. So if you take it to a conventional weapon, you're still talking in the hundreds of tons of very significant yield that China would produce. And what this really helps is this gives them exquisite data that they wouldn't have had otherwise available to them in their testing program. If we go back and we look and we think about how many tests we conducted versus how many tests China conducted, they only conducted 45, where ours is that 1,054. This is a significant area at which they can gather additional data. Now, some people might go, well, we still have an extensive test database that way outperforms anybody else. Russia had about 715 tests, if I'm remembering right, and they tested about 969 different devices. So they have an extensive test history that China does not have. But as I mentioned before, we've had a number of people in NNSA, both administrators and NA-10s in charge of the weapons program, get up and testify, as well as other experts, that we know a lot more now because of the science-based stockpile stewardship program than we knew then. So it would be foolish for us to think that China didn't get anything out of this test and that this wasn't advancing their program. And if we remember back to when we found those silos and we started to realize that there was a As Admiral Richards said, breathtaking strategic breakout that was occurring by China once we started to realize how many silos they were building and how much they were really advancing their nuclear program. That at that point really got a lot of people concerned about what were they doing. Well, it's no coincidence that around the same time you also have this test occurring. So I think that we should take these two things together and realize that China is breaking out, that they are breaking things that we would consider international norms, and they're not going to respect those. And therefore, we should reassess what is in our nation's best interest, and then see, just as President Trump said, we should be testing at a similar level. I would take it a step further and say that responsible nations should be conducting tests. I think that the threshold test ban treaty of limiting it to 150 kilotons and staying underground and making sure that there is no particulates that end up escaping your national borders, I think is also, I think, a responsible behavior. But that's to make sure that we have a reliable deterrent, that we have a safe deterrent, and that we do these things responsibly and well thought out. I think that creating this zero test ban or zero yield test ban treaty kind of idea, it doesn't meet up with the reality of the international security environment at which we face right now.
You know, it's interesting if you think back a few months whenever President Trump said that, you know, we needed to test again and we needed to test in a similar way to our adversaries. A lot of Americans saw this as kind of a shot out of the blue and were surprised by these comments, and they didn't really understood what drove it. And then now that both Tom DiNanno and Chris Shaw have spoken publicly about this Chinese test, and then some of the, you know, the testing, the limited testing that the Russians have done, I think it probably now makes a little more sense, you know, for those comments that President Trump made. You know, when was that back? 6 months ago, I guess, probably now.
Yes. And I think that a lot of people, they're concerned because they think that when they hear nuclear testing, they immediately think that we're going to go above ground. So we haven't done that since 1963 with the Little Feller test, which was actually one that President Kennedy was supposed to come out and see. It was of Davy Crockett recoilless rifle, which was pretty fun and an interesting historical program. But we wouldn't return to that. The limited test ban treaty, or also known as a partial test ban treaty, requires us to only be able to test underground. I don't think that we would abrogate that treaty and leave it. I think that we would try to do this in the most responsible way possible. I think that starting out in the hydronuclear regime makes a lot of sense. And then moving into areas to make sure that we're staying apace with our adversaries and that we're also addressing any problems that we notice within the stockpile, but also meeting new threats as they come online and making sure that we're ready to meet those kind of threats head on and that we can do the things necessary to deter conflict and not encourage it. And that, as you're fond of pointing out and others similar to Donald Rumsfeld, you know, weakness is provocative. And going after that and making sure that we're doing the right things. There have been others that have argued, you know, hey, what we really need to do is ratify the CTBT, and then we'd be able to go look at these issues and we'd be able to find out what they're doing. So that's flawed in a couple of different ways. The first way that's flawed is there's this thing called Annex 2 of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. So it requires 44 nations to sign and ratify before the CTBT can enter into force. So here's a couple of the nations that need to, or that have signed but have not ratified: China, Egypt, Iran, Israel, the United States, and now Russia also had signed and ratified, but they revoked that ratification back in 2023. And then there's a few countries that have neither signed nor ratified, and that's India, North Korea, and Pakistan. Interesting enough, for those that are keeping tabs, DPRK's last nuclear test was 3 September 2017. which is a little surprising for me because it feels like it wasn't that long ago, but now we're coming up on 8.5 years. So that's pretty wild. The other problem is that when you're down in these very low regimes, not necessarily what Chris was bringing up, Chris Yaw was bringing up with the hundreds of tons of a Chinese test, but if you're down there in the 40, 50 pounds of yield, this is something you could put in a containment vessel. Nobody would ever know that it happened, and you can hide it. So the senators at the time that decided that ratification was not in our interest because I can't verify a zero yield CTBT, I think that they are proven wise beyond their years, and they were correct that it was an unverifiable treaty. And as we've seen Russian behavior in the past, the Russians cannot be expected to follow any treaty. And then the Chinese aren't really interested in anything that provides transparency. Their strategic culture, especially their military culture, prides itself on deception and camouflage, concealment, denial of anything that's going on. They like to hide in that ambiguity and the uncertainty of what's going on because they think that it helps deterrence. And they think it helps them to have a military advantage as well.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Amlaw Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, with New START, you know, this is another thing. One of the big events that happened here recently was New START expired. And it kind of expired with a whimper, not a bang. And, you know, we're waiting to see, and we may wait for quite some time before anything meaningful happens that, you know, either way to suggest that New START was good or bad. But New START's gone. And there's been some discussion in the last week or so. A lot of people have written articles about its end. What say you on in terms of New START and the end of New START?
New START is an interesting treaty because what ends up happening is folks are very concerned because they're like, well, this is the first time that the US and Russia or the Soviet Union in the past are unconstrained in nuclear arms. This is totally false because there was no constraint on non-strategic nuclear weapons. There was only constraint on strategic nuclear weapons. And then for a while, up until we finally withdrew due to Russia being in material breach of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF, back in 2019. So there were a number of systems, especially exotic systems, that China was, or excuse me, that Russia was cheating on the INF or the New START Treaty with. And it was mainly because actually it wasn't really cheating. They were not captured by the treaty because we didn't envision them. So things like we had talked about the underwater nuclear powered nuclear armed torpedo, or the air launched cruise missile that was nuclear powered and nuclear armed, or as some have humorously dubbed the Flying Chernobyl, those kind of things weren't captured by that treaty. There was even questions on Avangard, their hypersonic weapon. That was intercontinental range, not to be confused with some of the Kinzhal type weapons that they've employed over in Ukraine in a conventional role. But a hypersonic glide vehicle, that wasn't captured by the treaty either because it was only capturing ballistic systems. So there were a number of systems that no longer fell that were clearly strategic that were not captured by the treaty. Additionally, it's not fit to purpose. Frank Miller has mentioned this. We made that treaty in a totally different time where we were supposed to be having a reset in relations with Russia, the famous button from Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. We were supposed to be moving into this wonderful, wonderful time of cooperation and everybody was going to be good. And we had acceded China and the PRC into a number of different international organizations and we thought they would be well behaved. And then they had their strategic breakout. So I look at this and I go, no, this was only constraining the US. This was preventing us from doing what was necessary to respond, to make sure that deterrence holds, and to do everything possible to prevent war with either China or Russia by fielding the correct strategic forces that we need to respond to this two nuclear peer, or two nuclear near peer, soon to be peer, environment that we're faced with both a resurgent Russia and a really advancing power in China. And I think that anybody that's sitting there going, well, hey, we weren't restrained, or we are now unrestrained, and this is so unbelievable, I think they really need to look back at the historical record and realize that not only did arms control never, and this is something that's not recognized by most people, arms control never got rid of a single nuclear warhead, not one. What arms control addressed were delivery vehicles. So to say that we were constrained by this and it was preventing certain things, I think just it misreads both the historical record as well as the treaty's negotiation record, because this was focused on one specific area of competition, and that now this no longer fits. And that's what arms control is supposed to do. It's supposed to use diplomatic efforts to funnel competition into areas that we believe are to our advantage for our national security. And I think that New START was no longer doing that. And I think that thankfully, the president did not decide to take Vladimir Putin up on his offer to extend for a year, because this now allows us to address these issues appropriately. And it makes sure that in any future arms control, if there were to be, that we would enter in with both Russia and China, and not just a bilateral, but more of a trilateral piece. There is one other piece to this that's important. I know you've mentioned this before. Arms racing is not evil. Arms racing is not necessarily this terrible, terrible thing that happens to happen, and it's an unalloyed, you know, bad. It's not. Arms racing is much better than fighting a war. And if we have to arms race in this nation to make sure that we don't enter the Third World War, I think that that's money well spent in that competition. And I think it's interesting that we've entered an age of great power competition, but for some reason, people think that we shouldn't be competing in the competition, which if you're not competing in the competition, like, did you miss the note on what game we're playing and what's going on? And I think that if you want to ensure that deterrence holds, that you have to compete and you have to respond, not only based on the capability and capacity of the weapon systems that you field, but also to demonstrate that you have both the commitment and resolve to defend those vital national interests that you have.
Yeah. I mean, peace is far cheaper than war. By any measure, we're going to spend, you know, roughly half a trillion dollars on modernization, you know, and another $500 trillion on operating the nuclear force over the next few decades. And yet, you know, let's just count the cost of Iraq and Afghanistan, and that total cost, both in actual war fighting costs and then subsequent taking care of the veterans and all of that, is, you know, estimates up to $7 trillion. So even if you spend, you know, a small portion of that, and that was just on Iraq and Afghanistan, that wasn't even on a major war. So, you know, having a nuclear arsenal that has no peer is far cheaper and far more successful in coercing and deterring than, you know, appearing weak and giving Russia or China the view that, well, you know, I think we can take them. Because that's what I never want. I never want them to say, I think we got these guys this time.
Yeah, I 100% agree, Adam. And if you think about it, normally when you hear war, you hear things like blood and treasure. So then, what price are you going to put on the amount of American men and women that are serving in uniform if that war were to occur? And I think that the prudent and responsible way to go about this is to make sure that, you know, as President Trump says, peace through strength, as Ronald Reagan said, and making sure that we have the strength so that nobody ever questions our ability to follow through with those threats, or nobody ever thinks it's that time. This is another little annoyance of mine. Most people, we talk about strategic stability, and I know you and I have had this debate back and forth, like what really is strategic stability? And depending on the community that you come from, you'll get different answers, because if you talk to somebody outside the nuclear deterrence, or, you know, nuclear community in general, even, they'll talk about the lack of conflict amongst states, which I think the best way to end up with a lack of conflict is not mutual vulnerability, where the US is vulnerable to Russia or China, and then they are vulnerable to us. I think it's actually the asymmetric vulnerability. We're a status quo power. We're not looking to go out and take over everything in the world, you know, beyond what everybody looks at with President Trump's agenda as far as trying to make sure that the Monroe Doctrine that has long stood continues to hold, and that there is peace and prosperity in the Western Hemisphere. I think that it's important to look at that and go that pursuing an asymmetric capability against our adversaries is not a bad thing when we're seeking peace and they're seeking to overturn the international order. I think having that asymmetric vulnerability enhances our deterrent and makes sure that those do not, or those adversaries that are looking to attack our vital national interests, don't do so.
Yeah. Now, we are unfortunately near the end of the show, so I'm going to bring up Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants all guests three wishes so long as they talk about the topics we've been discussing. So with that in mind, Kiwi, what is your first wish?
So I think my first wish is that we return to, at minimum, hydronuclear testing on a equal basis with those. Now that we've had the announcement from Chris and others of what China's doing, is that we at least return to that, and that we start to expand our ability through the stockpile stewardship program to do more experimentation, to do more validation of the codes, so that we're not wholly reliant on, even though we're not today, but I don't want to ever see us point that direction, wholly reliant on just mod and sim. I think all models are wrong. Some are useful. I think our models are top-notch, world-class, and I think that the people that we have that are working on them are great, but I always want there to be an experimental side of that piece as well, and to make sure that we're always questioning those models and that we're never just relying on them outright. Yeah. I think my second wish would be that we take a realist view of arms control and realize that arms control is not always good, and that instead we think about what is in our best interest for national security, and that if that involves entering an arms race with adversaries that look to do us harm, that we have the guts and the financial wherewithal to do what's necessary to make sure that we have a top-notch deterrent, and that we do everything in our power to deter them from going against this nation's vital national interests, and that we can ensure that the Constitution continues to live beyond where we sit. So instead of just celebrating 250 years that we're, you know, that our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren are celebrating the 500th anniversary of America, and it doesn't doesn't fall on our watch.
Yeah, I mean, the arms control and nonproliferation, the folks that work in those fields, they have a priori assumptions in which all proliferation is bad and all arms control is good. And I don't think those are a priori assumptions that hold, because all proliferation is not bad and all arms control is not good. And so I would like to see, as part of any future efforts, I would like to see the case first for why non-proliferation, you know, why we don't want, let's say, Korea, South Korea or Japan or what. Tell me why that would be a bad thing, and make a real case that can, you know, can be vetted and still stand. And then for arms control, I want to see why arms control for arms control's sake, which is, I think, mostly what we have, because we have thousands of people that work in professional arms control. So therefore, it's an industry. And, you know, if you think arms control is good and should be continued, make the case for it and let that case be challenged and let that case be vetted, because it isn't always good. I mean, we have cases in which we can prove over and over that arms control, particularly when we're the signatories, it doesn't benefit us. And we know our adversary is going to cheat, as the Russians/Soviets have long done.
I agree, especially on the arms control side. On the non-proliferation, I think you and I have a little bit of a delta. I'm all for U.S. vertical proliferation. I think that U.S. nuclear weapons are one of the key capabilities that keep us safe and that deter. But I also recognize that nuclear weapons, similar to Bob the Genie, there is no real genie that you're going to rub the magic lamp and be able to make nuclear weapons go away. So when I think about proliferating, or as like Curtis McGiffin likes to talk about, you know, maybe sharing.
Nuclear participation.
Yeah, nuclear participation instead of proliferation. On the horizontal, or the vertical, excuse me, the horizontal proliferation part, I'm not such a fan, just because I look at history and I think about who is our ally today may not be our ally. I think we have great allies. I think we have deep cultural connections. But if you look at the NSS, there's even questions about, you know, will Europe remain recognizable in the future? Will they continue to hold the values that we have in common, which is why we're such great allies? And even in Europe, we go back 250 years. And if we think about that, who were we fighting? We were fighting our greatest ally for our own freedom. So when I think about it, I go, well, if I fast forward 250 years, like we talked about before, and we're celebrating the 500th anniversary, are all the allies that we proliferated to, are they still going to be our allies, or are they going to be run by different folks, or are they going to have different values and views? And I think that's where I'm a little more concerned on the horizontal proliferation part, but I'm with you on everything else.
That's a fair point. Okay. So you got your final wish. What's your final wish?
Okay. This one's unconventional, and we, which nuclear is usually considered unconventional. But we did touch this a little bit when we were talking about INF and we were talking about battlefield type systems. And that's, you've written something about this in the past, as we talked about, we have a strategic triad, but do we need a battlefield or a theater triad? And I think there's actually probably three. I think that there is a strategic triad. I think that there is a regional/theater triad, and I think that we need a battlefield triad as we move back into this new era of nuclear competition, as we have this unprecedented two nuclear peer problem. And I think looking at the unique attributes of the triad for air, land, and sea makes sense for systems that are both at the strategic level, the theater regional level, and the battlefield level. And I would like to see us consider that much more than just thinking about theater nuclear systems. You and I have talked about this before. I think that one of our true advantages, and one of the reasons why INF was signed, even though it was numerically not in the Soviet Union's interest, was because Pershing II and Glickham were close to the Soviet Union, because America likes to play away games. We don't play home games. We don't fight on our own territory. We fight on your territory. So when we station our weapons over in foreign areas, this is one of the things that I think Vladimir Putin's going to learn to regret, which was, hey, I'm going to field all these theater systems and the U.S. isn't going to do anything about it. And then all of a sudden, he's going to look up one day and he's going to realize why Gorbachev signed INF. And that was because his theater systems hold my allies at risk. My theater systems hold your, if you had them, allies or coercive partners, and you at risk. So they do stuff on the battlefield, they'll do stuff in the theater, and they can even cover some strategic type targets as well. So I think when you look at all the unique attributes across, I think having a three triads,
a triad of triads,
the triads of triads, I think people will probably go, Kiwi, we can't afford this, that we'll never get there. But I think at least entertaining that idea and then looking at it from a logical standpoint and then looking at it from an attribute standpoint, I think we'll realize could fill a number of different gaps that we see in our deterrent posture and make sure that no one challenges this great nation.
All right. Well, with that, I'll let that be the last word. Colonel Derek Williams, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam.
And thanks to you, the listeners, as always, you're a great audience. We're thankful to have you. You're certainly one of the best in the podcast world. I bet you we've got more PhDs and more engineers and more physicists that listen to our podcast than any other. So it's a great place to be. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.